The policy debate over how the government should deal with debt during an economic downturn has been going strong for years now, and it was the number one issue in last year's presidential election. Some believe that sustaining and increasing government spending is the solution, while others argue that spending cuts, belt tightening, and austerity are the best approach. Nobel laureate Joseph Stiglitz joins us now for a look at this issue. He served as chairman of President Clinton's Council of Economic Advisors and as senior vice president and chief economist at the World Bank. He's a professor at Columbia University and the author of a number of books, the most recently, The Price of Inequality, How Today's Divided Society Endangers Our Future. It's published by Norton. Welcome back to our show.
Nice to be here.
Recently, a report by Harvard economists Kenneth Rogoff and Carmen Reinhart, which had been cited by many who supported austerity measures, including Paul Ryan, has been found to have had some faults. Can you talk about the report and their findings?
Well, what they had claimed was that if debt-to-GDP ratio exceeded 90%, there was a marked slowdown in economic growth. And the implication of that was that we were at risk having expansionary policies, government spending that was debt financed, and therefore we a strong argument for austerity. Now, what a study by three economists up at University of Massachusetts at Amherst showed that there were a number of very serious technical flaws in their report. And people subsequently looking at the data, or actually before that, had already pointed out a number of deficiencies in their study. Let me just sort of mention a couple of them. The new look at the data makes it very clear that there is no break at 90%, no statistical significant break. So that claim, which had been the basis of a great deal of anxiety about whether we were approaching that 90%, that claim was just wrong. A number of, you know, the evidence does suggest that on average, countries with a high debt grow slightly slower than those with lower debt. And the question is why? And this is where causality, the question of is it the debt that's slowing growth or is it low growth that causes the high debt? And we've seen very clearly in the context of the United States one answer to that question. Our debt has been increasing because of the low growth, and no one would claim that the debt was the cause of the slow growth. So, the deficit did not cause our recession. The recession caused our deficit.
Rogoff and Reinhardt wrote an op-ed piece for the New York Times in which they argued that a few errors don't disqualify the overall correctness of their research, citing a long history of economic ups and downs.
Well, as I said, the point is that the existence of a correlation has been noted before and is not being disputed. It's the question of what you make of that negative correlation. Is it the debt that's causing the slow growth or the slow growth that's causing the debt? And when you look at these episodes, it becomes very clear that the causation can go the other way. People have looked at it. Let me just give you a couple of other examples of both the criticisms and the inferences that the policy implications. The UK had a very high debt-to-GDP ratio, actually for 100 years. In spite of that, Industrial Revolution, which led to the highest rates of growth that had been seen up to that point of time. The United States, at the end of World War II, had a debt-GDP ratio of 130%, and yet in the years after that, we had the fastest rate of growth that we'd ever had, and it was shared growth. So the critical issue is there are a number of different circumstances that different countries are in. And so in the policy debate in the United States should focus on, are we one of those countries where you should be worried about the debt bringing down growth, or one of those countries where you should be worried that not spending money, not expanding the economy, will actually put in jeopardy our future economy?
Now, Rogoff and Reinhardt aren't alone. There was another study by Alberto Alacena and Silvia Ardagna that has also been reworked by the International Monetary Fund, and its findings have been reversed. How easy is it to manipulate economic data and statistics to prove whatever point you want to make? Forgive me for asking this. Can you be accused of the same thing?
Well, I think the answer is one always has to be careful about selective use of data, and one always has to be careful about interpretation of data. This issue of what we call causality is always going to be present, interpreting what is really going on. So let me talk about De Alacena and his colleagues' paper for a second. They argued that there was this notion, peculiar notion of expansionary contraction, that some governments had succeeded in expanding their economy even as they engaged in austerity. When you started looking at the episodes more carefully, what you saw is that there was something very peculiar about each of the circumstances, by peculiar, special. For instance, if you were a country where your trading partner was expanding, then you could fill in the gap caused by low government spending by expanding exports. If your interest rates were very high and you cut back on government spending, the central bank could lower the interest rates, stimulating investment, and that could fill in the gap caused by the cutback in government spending. The situation in the United States and the situation in Europe, though, today is one where neither of those hypotheses are plausible. Our trading partners are growing slowly, so we're not going to fill in the gap by more exports. Interest rates are at zero, so we're not going to lower interest rates any further, and we're not going to get much of a boost from monetary policy. So when you look at the circumstances that we are in the United States today, that Alacena results are absolutely irrelevant. And that's why the IMF came to the conclusion. Let me say, the IMF has not been exactly a left-leaning institution. But the IMF looked at the data and said their results are irrelevant. Today, countries need expansionary policies.
Well, this isn't the first time there's been an economic crisis and a recession and a slow recovery, either here or in Europe. Can we learn from what happened in the past?
We can, but we have to be very careful. This is the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression, and that's one of the real problems. We really don't have a lot of data in advanced industrial countries of prolonged, deep downturns. You know, they happen every 50, 75 years, fortunately. And so, and the structure of the economy today is much different from what it was 75 years ago. There's been globalization. We've moved from agriculture to manufacturing. We're now in the process of moving from manufacturing to a service sector economy. So you have to interpret the past with a great deal of caution. And you actually have to think, not just quote previous data.
A listener, in fact, writes in this regard. He says, while everyone focuses on the government's fault in the national debt and low employment, isn't it due largely to the private sector's massive employment of workers overseas that's brought some of these problems on?
Well, that was one of the factors clearly contributing to the economic downturn. Obviously, the shenanigans of the banks, their excessive risk-taking, the bubble, was another factor contributing to the economic downturn. But whatever your analysis of the causes of the bubble, the fact is the economy is not self-correcting. If the economy were self-correcting, we'd be well out of the downturn. When you have inventory cycles where the private sector overinvests in inventories, then it uses up those inventories, and once those are used up, the economy starts going again. Occasionally, you have economic downturns caused by the central bank, the Fed, stepping on the brakes too hard by raising interest rates. When it sees the mistakes, it lowers the interest rates, and then the economy recovers. This is a kind of economic downturn, as I say, that we don't see that often, fortunately, which is not an inventory cycle, which is not a cycle caused by the Fed stepping on the brakes too hard and raising interest rates. it's really caused by it's a credit bubble. It's a housing bubble that broke, and we are now living with the aftermath. And that's distinctly different from many of the crises that when people look at data over the past, they're talking about.
Last week, Paul Krugman wrote in the New York Times that there's a widespread desire to see economics as a morality play, to make it a tale of excess and its consequences. Do you agree?
He's absolutely right in that. And you see that even more in Europe, where Germany is often lectured the other countries like Greece, and they say you shouldn't have spent so much. But in giving that lecture, they forgot the fundamental point. If Greece were the only problem, Europe would have recovered from the crisis. Spain and Ireland had a surplus, not a deficit, a surplus before the crisis. They had low debt GDP ratios. No one could accuse them of fiscal profligacy under standard criteria. And yet, they had very deep downturns, and they are not recovering. And the austerity has made their downturns even worse.
Well, why has austerity gained so much support and influence?
I think it has something to do with those on the right wanting to use this as an occasion to downsize government. There actually is another perspective, another way of stimulating the economy, which would be to raise taxes and raise government spending in tandem. It's called the balanced budget multiplier, and strong evidence that if you did that, the economy would expand by amount as much as two times the amount of the increased taxes. So a real deficit hawk who was concerned about the plight of the unemployed would say, okay, I don't want us to increase our deficit, but what I want is increased taxes and increased spending and to match. None of the people on the right have been advocating this balanced budget, and that leads you to suspect that there's another agenda here of actually downsizing the government.
Because austerity measures most often affect things like social services, preschool programs, welfare, food stamps, public transportation, higher education. But the only time we hear a peep from Congress is when it's hard to get a plane out of the airport on time. During the presidential campaign, Paul Ryan warned that we would end up like Greece if we didn't solve our deficit problem. The deficit was seen as the number one issue facing the nation. Do you think it is?
No, absolutely not. And that kind of reasoning shows a lack of understanding of the differences between Greece and the United States. United States issues debt in our own currency. We are a global reserve currency. And that puts us in a distinctive position. Right now, we can issue debt with a negative real interest rate. That is to say, taking account of inflation, the interest rate that we pay is actually negative. And that means that if there are we take that money and we invest it in infrastructure, education, technology, any of the enormous needs that we need in the public sector, we actually strengthen our long-term economic growth. At the same time, we create new jobs today.
I'm talking with Joseph Stiglitz. His latest book, The Price of Inequality, How Today's Divided Society Endangers Our Future, is published by Norton. We'll continue the conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel laureate, professor at Columbia University. His most recent book, The Price of Inequality, How Today's Divided Society Endangers Our Future, it's published by Norton. And people have been writing in with questions. Tom from Seabright actually called in to ask why the country's leaders don't seem to acknowledge the diminished prospects people have of finding work. Are they trying to reset our expectations, he asks.
I think there is always hope. And when you have a president who wrote a book, The Audacity of Hope, it's clear that you don't want to give up that hope. So to me, I don't find that surprising. People in the administration are hopeful that the unemployment rate will gradually get down so that we are something near full employment by the end of the term, of his term. I'm not quite so hopeful. And particularly I'm not hopeful if austerity continues in the way that so many Republicans have been pushing.
A listener asks, when you consider the true cost of debt, are you including the debasement of currency through inflation that invariably results? Although we haven't seen inflation, have we?
Haven't we seen inflation, the market does not anticipate inflation. We have these inflation index bonds, and we can look at those inflation index bonds in comparison to non-inflation index bonds to make an inference about the market's expectations about inflation. And the answer is they do not see inflation coming up. The reason we don't have inflation is that inflation is mostly related to shortages in the economy, and we don't have shortages. We have excess supply, excess capacity, workers who want jobs. The hope is, and the presumption, and I think there's some confidence in it, that the central bank, the Federal Reserve, will take out excess liquidity out of the system if the economy starts to show any inflationary tendencies.
Well, is resetting the economy part of this conversation? We had an economic boom based on a bubble. Is it possible to return to that level again? Should we adjust expectations of what a healthy economy should even be?
We shouldn't have a bubble. The real thing is we should have a healthy economy with full employment. So the challenge is, can we have a healthy economy based on, you know, with full employment, not based on an artificial support of a housing bubble, but based on our society meeting our real needs? And let's be frank about it. We have a lot of real needs. We have to retrofit the economy for global warming. We have an enormous number of people in poverty. We have enormous needs in infrastructure, deficits in education. So to me, the fact is that we are in a peculiar situation of having underutilized resources. At the same time, we have unmet needs. And it's a failure of our market economy and a failure of our government that we are not using these excess capacities to meet the needs that we have today.
When you say full employment, obviously you don't mean full employment. That's something that was rejected in the mid-40s, an attempt to really have full employment. What do you mean? 10%, 5%, 3% unemployment?
There are two ways the economists talk about this. It's the rate of unemployment above which we start to have accelerating inflation. Mm-hmm. And there is some debate about what that rate is, but it's clearly much lower than the current rate of unemployment. So we could, you know, we had unemployment down to 4.2% under the Clinton administration and no signs of inflation. So I think that we can clearly get the unemployment rate down substantially before inflation would set in.
Now, Rogoff and Reinhardt's study claimed that when debt exceeds 90% of GDP, economic growth slows sharply. Even if they were correct, how close are we to a 90% of GDP right now?
Well, this is another flaw in their study. They didn't distinguish clearly between whether it's net or gross debt. A lot of the debt of the U.S. government is held by the U.S. government. So it's like an internal bookkeeping arrangement. Part of the government owes money to other parts of the government. So we often distinguish between the overall debt, the gross debt, and the net debt, the debt held by the public. So right now, the Fed holds a lot of the debt. The Social Security Administration holds a lot of the debt. If we look at the net numbers as opposed to the gross numbers, we still have some way to go. But let me reiterate the basic point that as the numbers, the Rogoff and Reinhardt study has been reexamined, there is absolutely no evidence of a significant break at 90%. That was perhaps the most important critique that was brought out in the critique of the Rogoff-Reinhardt, and they have not, in their response, given a retort to that specific claim. They have reiterated their belief that there is slower growth, but they have not shown that there is a break at 90%.
People like to draw comparisons between a household budget and the national budget. There's the notion of a family having to make hard decisions to pay down its debt after living beyond its means. Does the same thing apply with government?
No, that's one of the big fallacies. Paul Samuelson, one of the great economists of the 20th century, at the center of his textbook was what was called the fallacy of composition. Thinking this way was actually dangerous. The point is that when the government cuts back on its spending, its income goes down. Jobs get destroyed, unemployment increases, tax revenues go down. And so repeatedly, we found that the governments who have undertaken austerity have found been disappointed at the improvement in their fiscal position. And we saw that just most recently in the case of the UK, where it said it was doing the austerity to improve its fiscal positions to maintain its AAA rating. In fact, as the economy slowed down, its tax revenues went down, and it lost its AAA rating.
Does the EU complicate things, the fact that Germany and other countries with economic power are able to set standards for the rest of the countries in the EU?
Well, the EU does complicate things, and the reason it complicates things is that exchange rates can't adjust. So one of the ways that Greece would have responded in earlier days to its economic problems would be to lower exchange rate. As exchange rate lowered, it would attract more tourists. It would be a cheap destination that would reinvigorate their economy. As their economy revived, tax revenues would go up. Their fiscal position would improve, and things would get much better. Unfortunately, as part of being part of the EU, they cannot lower their exchange rate. They owe money not in drachma but in euros, and they don't control the euros. And so they're in a difficult position.
And today, Greece announced that it'll cut 15,000 government jobs. The country's deeply in debt, struggling with the conditions of the EU bailout. Do you think that this is the right approach? It sounds like they're going the opposite direction from what you would advise.
Well, what is clear is that Greece, like Spain, is in depression. The youth unemployment in Greece now exceeds 60%. Youth unemployment in Spain exceeds 50%. Overall unemployment in Spain exceeds 25%. Similarly, in Greece, the shortfall in production in Italy exceeds that of the Great Depression. So we haven't been using that word, but these parts of Europe are in depression, and the recipes that have been pushed from, particularly from the EU, from Germany, have made that depression, have actually caused the depression, have made things worse. The only way for them to get out of this is going to be with more assistance from Europe, with creation of what we call a banking union, more of a fiscal union, issuing euro bonds. There are ways that they can get out of it within the framework of the eurozone, but it will take more European action.
So they couldn't do it on their own, take a Keynesian approach?
Well, if they try to do it on their own, what is going to happen is, A, they won't be able to get the funds, B, they would have to borrow even if they could get funds, and that will increase their indebtedness, which will be a source of instability. So if they could, if Europe as a whole issued bonds, they could borrow at low interest rates and use the savings from their current high interest rates to reinvigorate their economy. These countries are paying very high interest rates. Money is fleeing their countries, moving out of their banking system. So it's not only austerity in the public sector. They're facing a credit crunch in the private sector, and the combination of the two is proving lethal.
When President Bill Clinton took office in 1993, there was a significant budget deficit. He managed to turn it into a surplus by the time he left office in 2001. You were the chairman of Clinton's economic advisors. Can you describe how we got into that debt and how we got out of it? And were Keynesian approaches used? Because I don't remember Maynard Keynes even mentioned at the time.
We were very consciously using Keynesian approaches. We very much said that we would not focus on government spending, austerity, cut back, until the economy recovered. But what we said is the moment the economy recovered, we would put our house in order. We would use this period of prosperity to bring our deficit down. And that's exactly what the Clinton administration did. So that by the end of the Clinton administration, there was actually a surplus. So the sad thing was that the Bush administration then took that surplus and turned it around and made it into a deficit. And there were just four things that they did that turned it around. The first was tax cuts for the rich beyond our ability to afford. The second was two very expensive wars in Afghanistan and Iraq that did not increase our security. Third was a increase in corporate welfare benefits to large corporations that didn't help either the economy or ordinary Americans. And the fourth was the economic downturn. The point that I made, that recessions cause deficits, it's not the other way around.
What about, you mentioned the tax cuts. President Reagan increased taxes. The first President Bush did, although he got in trouble with the Read My Lips problem. Bill Clinton raised taxes. Why do so many people say today that we can't tax our way out of debt?
Well, I think we actually can partly do that. We have to be careful right now, because if we were to tax ordinary Americans, it would lead to a cutback in consumption, and that would weaken their economy. We can increase estate taxes. We can increase taxes on the upper 1%, and because the upper 1% is getting so much of our national income, raising taxes on the upper 1% would, in fact, raise substantial amounts of income. So those are kinds of taxes which we could raise now. I think what we will have to do when we get back to prosperity is to raise taxes at the top. And there's some interesting studies that have been done recently that have showed that raising taxes from the top does not reduce economic growth.
Now, we have very little time, but I wonder about your thoughts on sequestration. Some people have said that it's really a terrible thing. Others have said it's not so bad after all. What do you think?
Well, basically, sequestration is a expenditure cut, and now is not the time for an expenditure cut. Now is the time for actually more expansionary activities on the part of the federal government to stimulate the economy. We are still, our unemployment rate is still unacceptably high. Suffering is unacceptably high. The other objection, of course, to sequestration is that it's across the board. It's not targeted. So if we were going to have cutbacks, we should try to make sure that we maintain our investments in the future. We cut back on corporate welfare. And we increase taxes on the top. We increase. There are many of these tax reforms.
Unfortunately, I have to leave it there. But you will continue this conversation tonight with Robert Kuttner at NYU Global Center. That's at 6 p.m., I gather. More information
right
on our show page at WNYC.org. People can also read your book, The Price of Inequality, How Today's Divided Society Endangers Our Future, from Norton. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Well, thank you.